This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Phil Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network Humanist News. Network News.
It's May 26th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jenda Huang.
And I'm back. I'm Duncan Crary. I am the former host of this program.
That's right. And we are all three podcasting together from the Circe headquarters studio in Albany, New York.
I thought we were in Steve Tyler's basement in Aerosmith.
It seems like it, doesn't it?
Where have you taken me?
We are surrounded by rock. We've got drums. We've got mics. We've got this beautiful sea blue color. It's nice.
Yeah, we got some frilly scarves tied around the microphone stand. That's what I thought we were in Aerosmith country.
Nice.
So, Duncan, welcome back.
Well, thank you. Listeners, some of you may remember me. I hosted this show for a few years.
That's right, Duncan.
It's been a year. And I was just walking down the street today in this black SUV with tinted windows rolled up. And somebody grabbed me and dragged me inside and took me to Steve Tyler's basement. I don't know what's going
That's
on.
That's right. We blindfolded him. We drugged him. So if he has any off-the-wall comments, you can blame it on the drugs.
We take no responsibility for it.
It's the roofie. I've been listening to your show, guys. You've been doing a great job. It's been a lot of fun to,
thank you.
To hear. I think the program has been in capable hands.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, but actually, Jenda, would you mind telling our listeners why I'm actually here? Because I'm here to celebrate something, right?
Yep, this is the Humanist Network News' 50th episode, and it's also the one-year anniversary of HNN coming under the umbrella, so to speak, of the American Humanist Association. So we thought it would be a good time, not only for me and Jess to maybe reflect over the past year and all the past 50 episodes, but to bring you back since we had a little GPS tracker on you. So we've been following you for a long time.
You're never actually truly out of the movement.
That's right, Jenda. You can't actually ever get out of the movement. You know that, right?
It's good to know. Good to know. Yeah, I will take this time very quickly to announce that this is actually going to be my last episode. I am going over to the dark side. And by that, I don't mean Christianity or Islam or anything. I mean, I'm going to become a government contractor. So, but yeah, I got an opportunity to join a firm at the National Institutes of Health doing some health safety stuff. So I'm going to take a little break. I've been in the movement for far, far, far too long. So
really?
I think it's time for a little change of pace.
My question for you, Jenna, is if at some point in the future, we get to do an episode on zombies and viruses and things of that nature.
Yes, I will. I will call in or fly in. Or
will you be our expert?
I will be there for
right?
you.
Because isn't that what you're going to go do?
You're going to be wearing those scary suits that they put on with yeah. the.
Exactly. I'm going to be doing some health safety stuff, working with like biohazard labs yeah. and whatnot, and kind of the making sure that the one on campus stays safe and whatnot. So
that sounds like fun, Jenna. But you got to watch your back for that black SUV because it
that's
it
right.
comes up. Yeah,
it'll come and get you.
I know, Jess. I think she said she was going to put the tracker in me later today before I left Albany.
Absolutely. Let's get one thing straight though. The SUV is gray. It's not black. And we've got a great show for you guys this month. As Jenna mentioned, all three of us are going to be picking some of our favorite past clips and interviews that we've done over the last few years. But before we get into that, we've got some news to report on. Jenna, why don't you fill the folks in on that?
Yeah, this is about the Second Chance Prom, which, as a lot of listeners know, happened last week in Mississippi. And we're going to actually first start out by playing a short clip from Roy Speckhart, who is the AHA's executive director. And he was on Proud FM, which is a Canadian radio station, talking a little bit about the prom.
The Pride of Toronto, 103.9 Proud FM. I'm Bob Ouellette on your drive home. Joining me on the phone is Roy Speckhart. He's the executive director of the American Humanist Association. And over the course of last weekend, they threw a huge party known as the Second Chance Prom. But before we get into that, Roy, why don't we inform some of our Canadian listeners, we are based in Canada, what the American Humanist Association is.
Thank you, Bob. The American Humanist Association is an organization that was established essentially to advocate for those who believe that you can be good without God.
Interesting. Good with, and it's been around a long time, right?
Oh, yes. We've been in existence since 1941, and we have been played a strong international role as well as a national one here in the U.S.
So the American Humanist Association heard the story of Constance McMillan. Rather than me tell the story, why don't you tell me how the Second Chance Prom came to be and how the American Humanist Association came involved?
Well, the AHA and humanists in general advocate on behalf of a lot of different issues that are stem from our commitment to science orientation for finding facts and compassion for humankind. And out of that comes a lot of progressive viewpoints, such as supporting the equal rights of gays and lesbians. And so when we heard that the school had not only forbid Constance to bring her female date with her, but then canceled the prom when faced with litigation from the ACLU, rather than hold it with her and her date present, we felt this was a chance for us to step up and show how we can be a positive force without having a religious background.
Right. So basically, just for those who don't know, it was the Itumbo Agricultural High School in Tupelo, Mississippi?
Correct? That's right. The northeast quadrant where there's not a lot else.
There's not a lot. Yeah, I think when I read, there's something like 8,000 people there. And Constance wanted to bring her partner. And they went so far, actually, they were going to throw a fake prom for her and some special needs students. It was a really horribly heart-wrenching story. It was unbelievable. And then so the American Humanist Association had some help from people like Lance Bass and Green Day, the rock band of all things. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, a lot of folks saw this as just a horrible experience and wanted to show that the rest of the world has a more favorable view of people who just want to be in a good, loving relationship and has nothing to do with whether they're same sex or opposite sex. And so a lot of folks, Ellen DeGeneres, a group called Tonic.com, Green Day, Lance Bass, Questlove from the Roots Band decided they were going to show their support.
That's an amazing story. And what I find, like the whole concept of being a humanist, caring for others without really having any religion attached to it is a fresh of breath air. It's very nice.
For a long time, whenever I was on a show addressing general public, people would ask, how can you possibly have any kind of moral beliefs if you don't get them from faith in God and in religion? And I think that people are realizing more and more that our morality and the way we look at things comes really from a more innate sense of what's right and wrong that we learn as we grow older.
Yeah, I believe there's a I guess you call him a non-theologist, Christopher Hitchens.
Right.
He's got a very, you know, slanted take on it, and basically saying that our morals as human beings are innate, and it doesn't come from some fear of hell or wrath after death or anything like that.
That's right. And, you know, psychologists like Jean Piaget and others have said that really that's something that naturally develops in the early childhood even, and it is not necessarily attached to a particular faith.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us, Roy. How can people get a hold of you if they want or learn more about the humanist movement, or for that matter, if there's going to be another Second Chance Prom next year, or how can they get involved in their own communities?
Well, the main organization can be found at our website, www.americanhumanist.org. There's also a LGBT Humanist Council that we recently launched, because there's a lot of folks out there who don't happen to believe in God or free thinkers or humanists and want to get involved specifically as that in the LGBT movement. And so we've formed that, and you can check that out through our website as well.
Well, thank you so much, Roy Speckhart. He's the executive director of the American Humanist Association, and they helped throw the Second Chance Prom. Thank you so much for taking the time and joining us here on Proud FM.
Thank you, Bob.
That was Roy Speckhart as he appeared on Proud FM's podcast. And Jenda, why don't you catch up our listeners on what actually happened? Because the Second Chance Prom already happened, right?
Yeah, exactly. It happened, I believe, last week, and it was a great success from everything I heard. There are about 400 people there. 300 of them were students, high school students from not just the high school where Constance McMillan was at, but I think kids around the state, in fact, kind of came down for it. And there were about 100 parents or, you know, kind of adults and whatnot. And Questlove was there from the Roots.
Nice. And Lance Bass was there from NSYNC.
Yes, exactly. Formerly of NSYNC. And I believe Jimmy Fallon's
his DJ
was there too. And they they were all DJing for the show, and there was just, it was supposedly a lot of fun. I personally didn't get the chance to attend, but it was a good time, you know, sponsored by the AHA. I think Green Day was a sponsor, and yep. Orbitz, the website where you can find cheap flights, randomly enough, they co-sponsored.
And speaking of second chances, Duncan, now that you're out of the movement, now that you're taking on another sort of project, another podcast even, talk about your second chance.
Those are the segues that made Jess Constantine legendary, folks. Yeah, well, I suppose I could catch people up on what I've been doing. Some of you may remember me. I was the director of communications at the Institute for Humanist Studies, and I used to co-host the H&N podcast with Jess. And I started my own independent consulting business doing publicity and marketing. But I do also podcast. I have a weekly program with author James Howard Kunstler, who was a guest on the H&N podcast, I think number 25, with Philip Pullman. We have a weekly show where it's just the two of us talking about pretty much everything under the sun related to the human habitat, I will say.
Nice.
Architecture, urban planning, energy scarcity, and also just cultural issues.
Right. I like the tie-in that you guys made, that you often make with that, with like humanism, and humanists don't believe in an afterlife, so they focus on, or we should be focusing on, the human habitat because it's what we know we have.
Yeah, well, Jess, one of the things I thought about a lot when I was working for the humanist movement was that I would like to hear more discussions about urban planning, architecture, sustainable development, you know, to focus on the one world that we got, this third rock from the sun. And I've definitely seen some examples of people in the movement talking about those issues. And of course, the American Humanist Association published an article that I wrote about James Howard Kunstler in the Humanist magazine. But I would like to see more of that. That's what I'm interested in, and that's what we talk about week after week on the show. So
nice. And you brought some goodies, right, for us to play here?
Well, I heard a rumor that this was going to be a clip show. Of course, I'm a big fan of a clip show, so I brought my own clips with me.
Nice.
I do have a short clip from a recent podcast I recorded with Jim on the podcast, which is called The Kunstler Cast. And this is from a discussion about brutalist architecture, which I love the name. It actually comes from a French term for raw concrete. But if you travel throughout the world, Sao Paulo is a city with a lot of brutalism. Washington, D.C. has a lot of famous concrete buildings. And
let's not forget Troy, New York.
And of course, Troy, New York, they're currently knocking down this big concrete building down the street from me. So I wanted to talk to Jim about what's the history of these buildings, why did we build them, and what's going to happen to them. So this is James Howard Kunstler talking about brutalist architecture.
But now that we've talked about the form and how it fails in these buildings, I do want to end by addressing the issue of beauty itself, beautiful buildings. I know it's slightly subjective, but it's also an important matter that I don't think should be dismissed. These buildings are almost universally recognized as being ugly. And you have said before, Jim, that we must build beautiful buildings to honor our existence, right? That's the purpose of building beautiful buildings. Why is it important to honor our existence? I'm feeling kind of cynical right now.
Ooh, that's really, that's kind of a harsh one. We have to feel that our mission in existence, you know, not just as animals on some third-rate planet, but, you know, this whole project of civilization has some dignity and some meaning. And so we want to confer a sense of dignity and purpose on it. I think that's understandable. We want to make it something that's worthy of our affection. You know, even if it's just among us, you know, let alone what, you know, the cosmic, you know, forces like, you know, the hypothetical figures like God might think about what we're doing. And, you know, I think we want it to reflect what is best that we've discovered about our own cognitive processes and the human brain and our values and everything that goes into making us, you know, worth being here and worth continuing. I don't think it's a good thing at all for, you know, a group of beings to have a self-esteem problem, to think that they're not worth being on the planet they inhabit. There's perhaps an additional question as to why raw concrete may or may not be beautiful. And, you know, to some people, no doubt it is. There probably are elements of even some of these brutalist buildings that we kind of detest that, you know, are have some kind of appeal to them. They are not totally devoid of appeal. But on the whole, I think there are things about them that we recognize as being not friendly for us and not friendly for our future and for our spirits. And they kind of drag us down and degrade us and make us, you know, they have a baleful kind of personality. You know, aside from the sheer cynicism of the fashion-directed impulses of the architecture scene in the late 20th century, it is a little bit hard to understand why people would get off with fashioning things that are inherently baleful.
So brutalism does not honor our existence, Jim.
Well, I don't think so. And no. And we can kind of tell from the eagerness that people show to tear it down. And even though there may be some historic preservation strictures against doing that, I don't think very many tears are going to be shed when these things go.
No, I think there's going to be a big sledgehammer party in my town when this
thing comes out. In fact, yeah, there might be, you know, there might be a celebration that, you know, now you're finally rid of this despotic presence in your town.
Boy, that sounded like a humanist sermon.
Yes. The Church of Kunstler.
So again, folks, if you want to hear the actual episode where Duncan interviewed James Howard Kunstler, it's HNN episode number 25, and it's called The Golden Compass. Also featured in that episode is an interview with Philip Pullman. So, Jenda, speaking of sermons and humanism.
Yes, my first favorite clip from the past year was actually the interview that we ended up doing with Greg Epstein, who is the humanist chaplain at Harvard, and we were interviewing him about his book, Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. And it's interesting talking with him. And, you know, he's a New York Times bestselling author now that his book is, you know, all over the place. And I think he's been doing all sorts of crazy media. And in this clip that we're going to play, the question, I was trying to figure out how comfortable Greg was with critiquing religions, because I know, especially right when his book came out, there was a lot of attacks from so-called new atheist type people saying that Greg is soft on religion and this and that. So I asked him this theoretical question: if in some future there was just humanists and religious liberals, would at that point, would it be okay for us to start critiquing religion? And then this is his response.
I mean, I think we need to wait 50 years to start critiquing religion. I think that we're already doing it, and we should continue to make our critique. Look, people who haven't read Good Without God, I think may not realize that I'm very upfront in, you know, my critique of a lot of traditional religious theology. And I'm very, very upfront about the idea that there's no God, and that I'm not interested in any way in praying to a God or anything like that. You know, we have to be very bold about that. It's just a matter of being willing to build coalitions alongside that. The story that I tell is the story of Thomas Jefferson. I think that rather than looking forward 50 years, let's look back to the election of 1800. Because Thomas Jefferson, when he was running for president in 1800, was running against John Adams. And John Adams did this real Karl Rovian campaign against Jefferson, assisted by Alexander Hamilton, where they ran an ad that said, essentially, and you can read the details of it in the book, that you have a choice. They said to their audience, they said to Americans, you have a choice. You can vote for Adams and a president who believes in God, or you can vote for Jefferson. And in all block letters, they said, and no God. And Jefferson won the election, and he never denied Adams' accusations about his religious beliefs. Jefferson never denied that he was the man who later in life took a scissors to the Bible and cut out every miracle story and every contradiction and simply left the Jefferson Bible, which is the story of Jesus as a human mortal philosopher and nothing more.
Well, that was a blast from the past. This is like memory lane for me. I know Greg Epstein well, but I didn't realize he was on the other side of the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah, congratulations, Greg, with all your success. And folks, if you want to hear the rest of that interview, it's HNN number 45, Good Without God. Jendo, what's up next?
All right, the next clip, one of my favorites, was when I went to the Atheist Alliance International Conference out in Los Angeles, and one of the people I was able to talk to was Alf Arabius, who is an Arab atheist, who, that was, of course, is a pseudonym. And he was, you know, kind enough to sit down and talk with me about the Arab Atheist Network and kind of a little bit about the experience of Arab atheists in not only in America, but in the Arab world.
The reason why the Arab Atheist Network is not just any forum, but and it's much more important, is that this is the only way for somebody living in an Arab country to be able to converse with other atheists who are also living in the Arab world, because as in the in almost all Arab countries, it is not acceptable socially for somebody to be an atheist. In fact, it could be very risky. You know, at worst case, they could get killed. And the best case scenario, they'll be shunned by their family and everybody else. So, you know, in a hypothetical example, somebody is known to be an atheist in Syria, for example. First thing, he'll, if he's living with his parents, he'll probably be kicked out. He'll be shunned. If it is known, for example, by the local imam might actually take some action upon that, incite something against him, or try to, you know, first they'll try to talk him back. There's this rule where they're given 3 days of an opportunity to repent, and if that doesn't work out, it's either they either get shunned out of the society. A lot of the time, they're expelled. The lucky ones kind of manage to immigrate and move to somewhere else. But in countries like in countries where there's not as much lawless rule of law, I'm thinking Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, places like that. People, vigilantes, will essentially take things into their own hand and go ahead and just, you know, apply the official punishment for apostasy, namely death.
So authors like Ayaan Hirshali, she'll, you know, write a book, have a very strong critique of Islam, and a lot of people in the West, you know, from secular liberals, like people at this conference, all the way to, like, religious conservatives, you know, really kind of buy into it and really appreciate it and kind of look at her book and say, like, oh, look, this is a prime example, and here's an example of a liberated Muslim woman, you know. But does that, from your point of view, does a book like that and kind of the perceptions that we in the West get from it, does that kind of help the cause of atheists in the Arab world, or does it hurt it, or what's the impact that it has?
So Ayaan Hirshali Ali is actually a very good example. She has been on the speaking circuit for a long time now, and I was aware of her back when I was still a Muslim. And I remember at that time I didn't quite like her because she was attacking my religion. I obviously didn't feel, you know, take kindly to that. When I abandoned that and became an atheist and reread her book and gave it a second thought, I realized I still don't like her message. Her story, her latest book about infidel, is a very compelling story. She's a woman who's gone through really bad time, and she says that there are people who have gone through even worse times than she did, and this is something that, you know, breaks my heart and underscores how important it is to have rights activism be really stressed in this part of the region. Human rights, women's rights, etc. However, whenever she links her background to Islam, I have a couple of takes on that. First, a lot of what she criticizes about her cultural upbringing is essentially that cultural. If you go and ask, let's say, a cleric in Saudi Arabia, a very conservative country, whether females should be circumcised or genitally mutilated, as people prefer to call it, they will say no. That is not only not recommended, it is probably against, you know, some rulings. Genital mutilation is actually a very localized habit in the Nile Valley almost. It is in some places of Egypt, most of Sudan, most of Somalia, and even some of the non-Muslim societies there do that. So we can agree that genital mutilation is an aberration that needs to be eradicated. But then when you say, oh, they do that because it's Islam and that's one of the problems with Islam, basically, so first off, this is a false statement. Second, you're just asking Muslim apologists to, you know, clearly point out your error and essentially go on to discredit more of your arguments along those lines. So this is a very good example of a bad argument to be used in critiquing Islam.
Jenda, I'm just curious. You seem to have a personal interest in that topic.
I guess, you know, I have a fascination with foreign cultures, and, you know, I've always been interested in international relations and then kind of hearing about how atheists function in the Arab world. And I went to the Middle East after I was in Peace Corps. I spent like a month just kind of going through Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Israel. So I got a little bit of a taste for the culture. And of course, you know, Arab world is right in the middle of international politics right now. And I think, you know, there are maybe not a lot, maybe not enough to create a movement, but there definitely, you know, are Arab atheists there living in those cultures. And it's kind of interesting because it's so dangerous, you know, for them to kind of speak out, but to really kind of know what they're thinking. Because it's easy to hear people like Ayaan Hirsch Ali and Salman Rushdie and people who have left Islam and are in the West. But for those who are still in those societies, like how they deal with things on a day-to-day level, you know, I mean, we in America have problems with church-state separation, but it's very different in the Arab world.
Right. Well, folks, if it also interests you, listen to H&N number 43. That was the AAI convention, Darwin's Legacy.
All right. My last clip is with Sebastian Velez. He's a Harvard humanist who happened to be going down to the Dominican Republic right when the earthquake hit Haiti. And he'd been doing some relief work in one of the border towns. So he was literally one of the first people there with aid. And he was kind enough to sit down and talk with us afterwards after he came back about some of his impressions. So this is kind of a clip about his work going down there and how it's not really missionary work and how it contrasts with Christian missionary work.
Well, when you go down there, they always assume that you are a missionary.
Right.
Exactly. It's always the case they ask me, you know, from what church do you come from? Or they say, well, I thank Jesus for bringing you here.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, well, I'm not Christian. And, you know, I missed the call from Jesus. I'm like a little sarcastic, but playful. Like, well, I must have missed the call from Jesus because he didn't call me here. I just, you know, I'm not Christian. And I'm just here.
Right.
And instead of getting offended, people are like, oh, well, no problem.
That's good.
Like,
good.
You're just not Christian.
Right.
So it's not a big issue for them. I'm very careful with it because I don't want to be seen as proselytizing.
Sure.
Humanism. I'm like trying to exchange goods and aid and whatnot in exchange for, oh, now you have to accept my philosophy or whatnot.
Right.
But not proselytizing is actually a way of proselytizing for humanism, because you are telling people, hey, I'm not Christian, and you don't have to accept anything that I, you know, any little books or any fables,
exactly,
or stories or anything in order to get anything. And there are people out there who just want to help you because they think it's the right thing to do.
Right, and because you're human.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's great to hear about humanists actually getting out there in the world and getting their hands dirty and helping people in need. And I was listening to your previous episode, which was also on the topic of humanist charity and philanthropy, right?
Yeah. And there's a lot of organizations now. I mean, there's Foundation Beyond Belief. The AHA's had humanist charities going on for a few years. The Center for Inquiry has SHARE. And I know there's the Richard Dawkins Foundation.
So there's lots of ways that humanists can still actually either give money or they can actually go out and do actual development work or
definitely there's a lot more ways to help than, you know, even maybe 2 or 3 years ago, ways that people can really get involved, and not just on a national level, but I think a lot of local groups, like local chapters of the AHA and stuff, they've become a lot more aware of doing kind of community orientated event type things.
Great. Well, listeners, just to recap, HNN number 47, that's Sebastian Velez in Haiti, if you want to hear that full interview from the clip that Jenda just played.
All right, well, enough about me. Jess, what about you? What are some of your favorite clips from HNN?
Well, Jenda, from this past year, one of my favorite episodes was when Neil deGrasse Tyson gave his talk at the AHA conference last year in Tempe, Arizona. And I liked his message of just making science accessible to the general public, to all people. And that I think it's it puts a positive twist on something that the humanist movement needs, which is just focusing on, you know, something that we're grounded in, which is science, as opposed to something that we're not grounded in, which is religion. And it's getting the message out to everyone. I like that a lot. So here's a little clip from that talk that Neil deGrasse Tyson gave.
I'm honored when those among us who see my work and analogize me to Carl Sagan, who we all admired and loved, and how he could put science literacy on the map and make it sort of a national dialogue about what you know and don't know in the universe. And he did it with passion and compassion. There's a difference, though, between Carl Sagan and me. That difference is, and I'm embarrassed to say this, I don't have the energy to debate people whose brains are just completely tangled messes of irrational thought. So you have never seen me debating a UFO person, a religious fundamentalist, a crop circle person. You've not seen, have you? Have you? It's not. But my energy to enlighten is principally directed at trying to get people to think straight in the first place. Part of thinking straight in the first place is sort of not only trying to get adults with open minds to think straight, but of course kids. The core of science literacy is through what lens do you see the world? How does the world come to you as you look upon it? And that is not trained by buying a chemistry kit or by learning how your microwave oven works. That comes about by the stimulation of curiosity. It comes about by not valuing the answer as much as you value the pathways that may or may not lead to the answer. It's the pathways of exploration that enable you to probe the world around you. And so this book is about how to immerse the growing child in environments that stimulate that curiosity. And let me give you a couple of examples that I can report on thus far. These are intermediate results. This happened to my daughter. So my daughter is 7. Tooth comes out. I'm told that if you put it under your pillow, Tooth Fairy will come and swap it out for cash. She said, really? And I said, I'm told. No, I'm not lying, right? I'm told. So she puts it under her pillow. So sneaky. Now, I realize, maybe you only know this when you have kids, so why it is that the Tooth Fairy works? You know, I mean, why that whole story works? Because they lose their teeth over the years where they're most gullible to that kind of story. So it's just this few years where they actually just believe it. All right, so puts it under the pillow. She wakes up, there's money under the pillow. She said, Daddy, Daddy, Mommy, Tooth Fairy came. So I said, really? I said, how do you know? I said, well, there's money under the pillow. I said, how do you know it's a tooth fairy? He said, well, because you told me that it might be a tooth fairy. I said, okay, fine. So more teeth. This happens with more teeth. More money. And then I said, have you ever thought of testing whether, in fact, it's a tooth fairy? Do you want to, like, set up a camera or you know? And so I just started to put into her some level of doubt. Or not doubt, because doubt is that's, yeah, just pathways of inquiry to test the idea. So here's what happened. She began to think that maybe it's the parents who are swapping the teeth out with money. So she arranged at her school to do the test. And how do you do it at school? You get someone whose tooth comes out while they're at school. And then they don't tell their parents that the tooth came out, and then put it under the pillow without the parents knowing. Parents are dumb stupid there. They can't pull that one off. And so that was a way to test for it. And so it's this kind of inquiry. That it's got nothing to do with, like I said, your microwave oven. It just simply has to do with information and how you view the information that's coming to you. And it's not a matter of squashing fun storytelling. That's not what this is about. This is about just investigating what comes in front of you. And I'll give you just two more examples, and we'll just go to conversation. In another example, my daughter, when she was the right age to be a huge Hannah Montana fan, so I said, Miranda, I saw like a poster of Hannah Montana today. It was like huge. It was as big as a wall. You know what her next sentence to me was? She said, how big was the wall? Not all walls are the same size. It's that level of inquiry that I'm talking about. And like I said, I don't have her twin living in a box to test whether that twin would have made that same statement. But I can tell you that it's those kinds of statements that when she comes out of this scientifically literate, I don't care what she does in life, she's got what she needs to not be taken advantage of by others, as we know is so often the case, or to not become so captured in your ignorance that you then want to convert others to it. So thank you for
I love that guy. I think he's awesome.
He's a great presenter. Yeah, his talks he gave were really everyone loved it at the conference last year.
Yeah, I think he's a great face for humanism.
I was a little jealous actually because you did that pretty soon after I left. Thinking like, oh man, if I'd stayed a little longer, I could have met Neil deGrasse Tyson. I keep seeing him on The Daily Show and The Colbert Report.
The Colbert Report, yeah.
He's funny. And he made that really impassioned speech that was making the YouTube rounds recently about the funding cuts for space exploration. Did you guys catch that?
No.
Well, the lesson I learned is when your funding sources are in doubt, just warn people of an asteroid that may end all life on Earth.
Nice.
No, but seriously, it was a great rallying cry to continue funding space exploration and why we need it as human explorers.
Nice.
So, Jess, by the way, I heard you're going to meet Mr. Deity again.
Absolutely. H&N episode number 16, we had the opportunity to interview Mr. Deity, Brian Dalton, who's the creator of Mr. Deity, which is basically an internet TV series about the creation of our planet and the role of God and some of his disciples. And he's actually going to be making an appearance at AHA's 69th annual conference this June.
It's amazingly funny. I saw them live at the Atheist Alliance International Conference, and I'd never seen them before. I'd only vaguely heard about them, and I thought, oh God, an attempt by atheists to do humor. I was like, this is not going to turn out well. But I was extremely impressed. And then I went online and saw some of the episodes, and I just I think it's really high quality. So
definitely. Well, here's actually let's play the clip from Mr. Deity season one. So here's a clip from their show, and then after that a little clip of my interview with Brian Dalton as Mr. Deity.
So here's a clip about God negotiating the crucifixion with Jesus.
So, that's obviously that's the downside. But, after 3 days, we bring you back to life. And from that point on, it's a slam dunk.
3 days I got to be down, sir?
I said 3 days in the prophecies. But, there's fudge room. We could put you down late Friday, all Saturday. And then, raise you up at the crack of dawn on Sunday. So 36 hours tops. 35 if we did it on the week that they set the clocks forward.
Boy, I don't know.
Well, you'd be doing everyone a really big favor.
Yes, sir. And what's in it for me again, sir?
Well, like I said, you'd be a partner.
Junior partner?
No. This is full partner. Completely equal, one-third vote. Plus,
keep talking, sir.
Yeah. Plus, this could be a really good career move for you. Get you in on the ground floor.
Yes, sir. I must say, I really appreciate that offer. It's just, yeah. I guess I don't know why you can't just do it yourself, sir.
Look, I'd love to do it. I'm not chicken, if that's what you're... I don't know that that's what you're implying, but... Look, there's a lot of stuff to be done here still. Larry can't do it all. It's time, is what it is. Take time, trying to get the time off. Can't do it.
Right. Sir, and why can't you just forgive people again?
Because of the whole sin thing. That's killing us.
Right.
Sin equals death, so you go down and lead a completely sinless life, and death has no...
Whoa. Sir, did you say that I have to lead a sinless life?
I said that before.
No, you didn't.
I'm pretty sure
I did.
No, sir, you didn't.
No, I trust me, sir. I would have remembered that one.
Well, I apologize then because I was Larry. I got to take this. Hey, Larry.
Hey.
You're on speaker with me and Jesse.
Jesus.
Oh, Jesus. Sorry.
Hey, Larry.
Hey.
Hey, where are you?
I'm about 3 feet behind you. But I am in the 13th dimension. I was talking with the foreman earlier, and we're trying to decide how dark you want to go with the dark matter.
Yeah, take that all the way to void, and then back it off a skosh.
Oh, okay, great.
Thanks.
Hey, wait. Jesus was wondering...
No,
the health plan does not cover
crucifixion.
That's good. Did you just come up with that, or is that material?
Yeah.
Did you hear that?
Yeah.
No, he was just wondering how he does the whole sinless life thing.
Oh, it's fully God, fully human, sir.
Oh, I came up with that, right?
Yes, of course, sir.
Okay, all right, I like that.
Yes.
Okay, so when are you coming back?
Tuesday, sir.
Tuesday. Okay, well, how about this, you schmuck? Why don't you bring me back something this time, all right? Get me a T-shirt or something.
Will do, sir.
Never gets me anything. So you got that, right? Fully God, fully human. That's how you do the whole sinless life thing.
Well, that hardly sounds fair.
Why?
Well, are any of these people going to be fully God, fully human?
No.
Well, then, you know, this whole thing, it seems a little bit out of whack. I mean, you create these people, but then you make them way beneath you.
Well, I'm the deity.
Right, but, sir, then you expect them to live up to your standards.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, sir, and then you want to threaten to punish them with, you know, hellfire.
Hellfire.
Damnation. Eternal torment.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, this whole thing, it just doesn't really seem to make any... Oh, you're good. Oh, you're good.
You're getting the whole picture now.
Oh, I'm getting
the whole picture.
Oh, yeah, I'm getting it. Yeah, I'm being punked.
You go what?
You're punking me.
What does that
mean? Oh, what does that mean? You're good. Oh, yeah. Oh, what? What does that mean? Yeah. Where are they at? Huh? Where are they at?
Mr. Deity, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with me on behalf of humanists and people in the world in general.
Well, you know, all I have is time. So,
I have a couple questions about, you know, your master plan and some of the decisions that you've made.
Yeah, although I don't like the term master plan, it's too close to master race. If you could just avoid that, that would be appreciated.
All right. First, we might as well start at the beginning, I guess. Can you explain the whole rib thing to me? I mean, did the first woman really come from the first man's extra rib bone?
Well, the rib was the foundation, and then we built around it. You know, you have to have some basic DNA, so we took it from there, and we just kind of, you know, built the remaining structure around that. And I'll tell you, Adam wasn't happy with it, because it was, you know, this is back before the days of anesthesia, so very painful for him.
And so it was... then choosing women to bear the responsibility of reproducing your way of sort of balancing out the power?
Well, I just felt like I couldn't put Adam through any more pain at that point. So, you know, I'd already taken a rib. What am I going to do? You know what I mean? Plus, he didn't really have the correct anatomy. I could have shot it out the back end, the kid, but, you know, just not cool.
No, probably not. Was Mary really a virgin?
That whole case has been sealed. I am not allowed to talk about it by court order, and that's all I can say at this point. That's, you know, I'd love to talk more about it, but because of the settlement, you know, the whole child support thing and whatnot, I just can't say.
Could you at least tell me, like, whose name did you yell?
You know, I generally yell out Zeus. I mean, if you knew the guy, you'd love him as much as I do. You know, he's a good guy, always been there for me, very helpful. So, you know, that's my preferred name. Oh, Zeus. That's basically how it goes for me.
Can I quote you there?
You can quote me.
Awesome. So that was my interview with Mr. Deity, Mr. Brian Dalton, H&N number 16.
Good times.
Yeah. I can't wait to see him again. I can't wait. It's just, so, Jenna, you said last year you saw them perform live. I haven't gotten that experience.
Yeah, they did one or two skits from their shows. I think one was like a previous episode, and then they'd done something that they hadn't published yet, and both were pretty funny. I mean, you know, there's like, you know, 500-600 people at the conference hall, and everyone was just laughing at what was going on.
So, that's Jess, awesome. You got to make sure to ask them about the TV show. Are they ever gonna be on television?
I certainly will. I recall hearing that they were gonna have like a short, like they're gonna be like half episodes on TV.
So that's cool. Yeah, I'll definitely get his plans.
I think it would be interesting, especially in, you know, nowadays with all the kind of controversy with South Park and, you know, Muhammad cartoons. And I know Comedy Central is thinking about making a Jesus-centered cartoon, and having something like this on the air would be interesting to see if people complain or not, which, I mean, I'm sure they will. But
yeah, but you can't please everyone.
Why bother trying?
Yeah. So, Jenna, let's talk a little bit about the conference. Is it too late for folks to register?
Nope, it's not too late. People have until June 1st to register either online or via the phone. And then after that, you can just show up at the DoubleTree in San Jose and register in person there. And as a special bonus for HNN listeners, mm-hmm. Jess Constantine may be there herself taking your information. So this is your chance to finally meet the woman behind the microphone.
And discover for yourself why this is an audio-only podcast.
Duncan Crary.
That's for years. Years of those.
He's been
swipes.
Wanting to do that for so long.
I'm just kidding, folks. Jess is a beautiful woman.
Oh, thank you. That's nice.
With some avid fans, too. I've met some of them.
Well,
I was never asked for an autograph by any listeners, but
Jess was asked for an autograph, really.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it myself. She's looking like she doesn't remember this.
I never heard this story.
Keep talking, boys. Keep talking. So, on a serious note, I would love to see listeners there. So if you're there, if you happen to be attending the conference, let me know. We can record a listener comment or a bumper or something. So it'd be great to meet you.
That'd be great. So, Duncan, now that I am leaving the movement, what sort of advice can you give me? I mean, you know, looking back, how is, you know, what's your perspective on it now that you've had this year away from it?
Well, I do still peruse the pages of Hemant Mehta's Friendly Atheist blog mm-hmm. Now and then to sort of see what's going on, and I listen to the HNN. So I'm still trying to keep up on some of the things, but I would have to say that the one main observation I have is that when I was working for the humanist movement, I thought that this was just a unique little corner of the universe with certain rules about behavior. But I think I've discovered that human beings in general are kind of pack animals. We like to band together under certain things. And
right.
I have encountered several other movements and groups that all have the same arguments over what label to use and whether you should be more adamant about certain things or whether you should be more diplomatic.
Uh-huh.
So I think I've discovered that humanists are just like everybody else. How's that? Is that okay?
Absolutely, that works.
I do find though that I don't really speak about religion very often anymore.
Anymore, right?
And I mean, I've been out at bars and in social functions where someone else, you know, had nothing to do with me, mentioned, you know, being an atheist or being a humanist, and I didn't say, oh, I worked for 5 years for, you know, I just sort of let it play out and.
Right.
Just want to see what happened. And
so you actually talked about religion more when you were working in a non-religious movement than.
Oh, God, yes. Of course,
wah,
yeah.
Wah, wah.
No, but it's good to see things are moving on. And you know, I like to hear about the humanist charity work.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to hear about some of the progress that the Secular Coalition for America has made, getting a seat at the table in Washington, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Seems like it's a movement that's coming of age, right?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting what you're saying, because I've realized that too over my time in the movement. I think a lot of times when people first join, they feel that it's really a special and unique thing. And, you know, that worldview that we have is so different that, you know, that kind of puts us on like a moral, like not a moral, but like a separate plane when it comes to the way that we operate and stuff. But in reality, in a lot of ways, we're still just that kind of, we're just another social movement. I mean, we have very specific things that we want and we have a unique point of view, but you know, we're still people and we still interact with each other. And it's kind of interesting paralleling with other movements. Cause I remember when I was at the AI conference talking with Alf Arabius, and he was saying before, while he was still a Muslim, he would kind of attend various Muslim conferences. And what he told me was that the biggest difference between the atheist conference and a Muslim conference was the alcohol. But otherwise, in terms of, you know, in terms of the fact that a lot of times our conferences, you know, are kind of like cheerleading things for us. It's a way to like kind of celebrate us and to reinforce our own beliefs, and which, you know, isn't necessarily a bad thing. But he was just saying that's literally, he was like running away to go do something. And that was just kind of the last thing I was mentioning to him. And he was Like, yeah, difference is the alcohol.
Which is a major improvement, well, I'd
absolutely.
Like to say.
Said the Scotsman.
Well, so much of the humanist movement is conducted online.
Yes.
In this virtual space. And I think that it is beneficial to actually meet people face to face. I mean, one of the things I enjoyed going to the conferences when I worked for the Institute, I enjoyed meeting some of the people who I had corresponded with for up to a year by email.
Right.
Sometimes by phone, but mostly by email. And then you actually get to meet the person and interact.
Right.
In a tangible space. So, yeah, it's important to do that.
Quite a concept, huh?
Yeah.
Well, folks, that about rounds out HNN episode number 50. That's quite a benchmark for us, huh?
Yeah. What is it? The silver anniversary?
I think so.
Yeah. So what's the next big one going to be?
Yeah. How are we going to top this?
That's 60 or 75 or what?
75. And for that one, we're going to kidnap Neil deGrasse Tyson and bring him here to Steve Tyler's drum studio.
Even if he's on a spaceship.
Somewhere in upstate New York. Well, Jenda, I want to wish you the best of luck in your new career.
Thank you.
Same here, Jenda. It's been a pleasure working with you as Duncan. It's been a pleasure working with you.
Yeah, and it's been a great opportunity for me. I was, kind of drafted into doing this podcast, so I had no idea what was going on a year ago when I started this, but I feel I've learned a lot, especially under your tutelage. And so thanks a lot, and I've enjoyed myself, and maybe if I'm lucky, if I'm loved enough, I'll get kidnapped in some future episode and brought back here.
Oh, we're all coming back.
Absolutely.
You think that more people could fit in this room?
We have to see how many people we can get in here after the 100th, 150th episode of the podcast.
All right, well, that about wraps up our show. Listeners, I hope to see some of you at the AHA 69th Annual Conference this June 4th through 6th in San Jose, California.
Well, thank you guys for inviting me back. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed doing it.
Glad you could come.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
And I'm not sure if you're going to get some listener complaints about this. Who the hell was that?
Just for the record, folks, if you do want to complain about Duncan's performance today, no. If you have any comments or questions, as always, email us at hnn@americanhumanist.org. Visit our podcast page to listen to all of those previous episodes that we just mentioned at humanistpodcast.org.
And for those weeks that there's not a podcast, you can always catch the HNN e-zine, which is at americanhumanist.org/HNN.
Thanks for listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
I'm Jenda Huang.
And I'm Duncan Crary.
All right, so conferences are sort of they only happen a few times a year in the movement, and they're time for everyone to sort of get together and share their ideas and their plans for the future and talk about what they're doing in the movement. So it's time we get to see all people from all different walks of life within the movement. The ones who Julia Sweeney in episode number 12 called her peeps.
That's right.
In some ways, people expect an atheist organization to have oddballs, so you're already coming in with a preconceived notion that there are going to be oddballs there. And I always was such a lover of being involved with churches that to me, those people that you might term oddballs, I love them. I mean, to me, these are my peeps.